everybody. I'm Dr. Deborah Moshowitz's old man. I'm subbing for her today. And so we're stuck with each other, and we might as well make the best of it. Today we're talking about immunology. Now, immunology is a mess, but it's a glorious mess. And there's no completely systematic way to talk about it. The machinery of immunology is all interconnected. So what I'm going to have to tell you today is true to a first approximation. I'm going to tell you lies, in other words, and then I'm going to fix them up later. By lies, I mean simplifications, overgeneralizations, and then some of them, at least, we'll fix up later. We'll also treat some important processes as black boxes. What we're going to do is we're just going to pass them by and say what goes in and what goes out, but we can't say what the gears and wheels inside look like. That's probably better suited for an actual immunology course, which I happen to teach in the fall. So if you're not less curious about the subject at the end of this lecture than you are before, you might consider taking it. Okay. What's immunology about, anyway? It's about you and everything else. It's also about things that can hurt you and things that don't. You're always being bombarded by foreign substances all the time, and your immune system ignores it most of the time, because most of it isn't harmful. So the machinery of your immune system, that means the cells and the molecules and the organs and the tissues, they all work together to detect and to get rid of all these foreign invaders. And what do I mean by foreign invaders? It could be bacteria, could be viruses, could be transplants, could be cancer cells, could be fungi, or strange chemicals. Sometimes in an effort to blast away at the invader, there's some collateral damage to your own tissues. And sometimes the collateral damage is what predominates. The deadliness of the avian flu, for example, is not because of anything inherent in the virus pathogenesis, but because of an over-the-top immune response to the virus. Now, evolution has to find a sweet spot between having an immune system which can totally destroy any possible invader of any kind that could possibly harm you, and always do it without fail, and also having an immune system that never, ever, ever, never attacks your own tissues. It's a tall order. Also, evolution has to find a sweet spot between the cost of having an immune system that works perfectly and the cost of one that doesn't. So, we'll start with the obligatory history. Immunology goes back a long time. People realized thousands of years ago in China that if you recovered from an illness, you couldn't catch it again. So if you recovered from an epidemic, you could take care of people who were suffering from it. It's only recently people tried to take advantage of the phenomenon. When I was a kid, we had chickenpox parties, mumps parties. Mumps, when you get it as a grown-up, is a very serious illness. But when you get it as a kid, it's usually no big deal. So when one kid on the block got mumps or got chickenpox, all the other kids would come over and they would play so that you have your case early and you get it over with. Now we have vaccines. But when did modern immunology begin in the West? And here I'm going to have to like run back and forth and do this. Sorry about this, but I just discovered that if you turn off the lights, you can almost not take notes. No, that goes, oh, that one goes on, and this one goes off. Right? There you go. Now, can you take notes? Kind of, sort of like? All right, good. Well, this is the person who brought immunology to the West. She's Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. She was the wife of the English ambassador to Turkey, and she introduced the process of variolation. Now, where'd that chalk go? Here it is. Variolation, you take somebody who has smallpox, and you take some of his crusty lesions, and take some of the stuff from the gunk from there, and you scratch it into the skin of your kid. What that does is the kid then develops a very, very, very mild case. A pops or two, local, nobody dies, recovers from that, can't get smallpox again. She introduced it into England over a storm of protests from both the medical establishment, who said NIH, not invented here, so they didn't like it, and they thought it looked like quackery. First, do no harm. You didn't want to actually introduce the infectious agent into the skin. Of course, the route by which an infectious agent comes into you affects how you're going to respond to it immunologically. And the skin route is a particularly easy one for you to handle for smallpox virus. Usually it's inhaled. So, if you take my course, you'll find out why. But generally, this worked. And also, the church didn't like it either because you were interfering with God's plans. Anyway, she saved tens of thousands of lives, and she had a very interesting life. She was supposed to marry this boring baron, and she had herself kidnapped by her future husband. She had lots of admirers. Alexander Pope, Samuel Johnson, Edward Gibbon were all her admirers. Smallpox vaccine is one of the great successes of medicine, which came some 80 years after her, and it's finally been eradicated. So here is one of the last cases ever seen on Earth. And you may notice this child, by the way, he survived. You may notice that the lesions are centrifugal. That means they're away from the center. They're very comparatively few lesions on his chest, many, many on his face and arms and hands, sort of away from the center. If you take my course, you'll know why. But the point that I'm trying to make now is simply that your face ends up terribly, terribly scarred. And this face was that face, because as a young woman, she had contracted smallpox, and her face was terribly, terribly scarred, which was what motivated her to introduce variolation. Anyway, her last words were one of the best. When she died, her last words were, "It has all been very interesting." Okay, now it didn't take long after the first vaccines arrived, after Pasteur's work in particular, who was the first guy to really study vaccines systematically, for these two gentlemen to ask, this Kitsato and von Behring, they asked, what was different about an animal that was immune from one that wasn't? In other words, you take two bunnies. They had vaccines already in the late 19th, early 20th century. They vaccinated these one bunny against... It turns out that they used diphtheria, and they asked what was different about this animal from an animal that wasn't immunized. So they introduced a kind of experiment that's now a workhorse in immunology. It's called adoptive transfer. These experiments are done even today. It's kind of like if you have two radios and one of them doesn't work. Or you have, what you do is you swap parts to see what it is. So they had it. So here we have two bunnies. One is immune and one isn't. Well, maybe we can take something from the immune bunny and put it into the one who isn't and make that recipient bunny immune also. So they tried all kinds of stuff. Well, one thing worked. It was blood. Blood worked fine. So if they introduced blood from an immune animal into a non-immune animal, the non-immune animal became immune. And then they asked, what was it in the blood? Well, you can fractionate blood. Blood has a solid part, which are the cells, and it has a soupy part, which is called plasma. Well, the plasma did it. So if they took plasma from an immune bunny, they injected it into a non-immune bunny, the non-immune bunny became temporarily immune. But what about the plasma? If you let plasma clot, you get a whole bunch of solid stuff, and then you get something called serum. And serum did it. So he concluded that there was something in the serum, not in the cells, that would confer immunity. And a doctor's transfer became the basis of a business for passive immunization. It was the origin of the Iditarod, where they were taking antitoxin serum up to save some kids with diphtheria. Anyway, it didn't take long after that for somebody to ask, but what is it in the serum that does it? So a guy named Elvin Cabot started fractionating serum by electrophoresis. And here are fractions of serum, and you get a lot of, this is the anode, they move this way. The slowest moving fraction is called gamma. So there's albumin and a whole bunch of other stuff, and it turns out that this fraction was the richest in the stuff that conferred immunity. To make a long story short, and without drawing it out too long, they finally figured out that that fraction contained specialized proteins known as antibodies. I keep doing this with the chalk, don't I? There it is. Known as antibodies. And antibodies are specialized proteins, which are members of a family of proteins known as the immunoglobulin family, or IG family. There are many, many proteins that evolve from a common precursor, and they're all members of the IG family, the immunoglobulin family. Now, antibody molecules have the ability to recognize and glom onto foreign substances, to grab onto foreign substances, and that begins the process of eliminating them from your body. So, here's an extremely rough schematic of what an antibody molecule looks like. We'll get a better view a little later. So this is a quote-unquote typical antibody molecule, and it has two ends. It has two grabby ends. These are the ends that actually latch on to the foreign substance. And then it has an end that actually does stuff. So it's known as the effector function. Effector is just a fancy word for does stuff. So this grabs and this does. Okay? So these, if you look at any two, just take two random antibody molecules from you, they'll be different at this end of the molecule, the grabby ends, because they grab different stuff. But they'll be pretty much the same or very similar at this end. Now, here is what the definition of an antigen and an epitope is, and these are very much confused by students. The antigen is the molecule that the antibody recognizes. Here are two different antibody molecules, a blue one and a red one, and they're both recognizing the same antigen, this protein. This is supposed to be an alpha helix, and this is a beta pleated sheet or whatever. This antibody molecule recognizes this part of the molecule, but this antibody molecule recognizes a different part, a different little chemical grouping on the surface of this one. They recognize different epitopes on the same antigen. So the antigen is the thing that the antibody latches onto, and the epitope is the part of the thing that the antibody recognizes, okay? Sometimes another word for epitope is antigenic determinant. I'll try not to use it, but sometimes I do. Well, meanwhile, so we've now discovered the reason that people are immune. They have antibodies in their serum. The antibodies glom onto things and help eliminate them. Meanwhile, in Russia, a crazy guy named Eli Metchnikoff was looking through a microscope at blood from immune animals and from non-immune animals, and he dropped a little bacteria into both. When he looked at the, when he looked under the microscope at the blood of an immune animal, he saw these white blood cells come over and gobble up the bacteria. But when he looked, he dropped the bacteria into the blood of a non-immune animal, the white blood cells kind of poked around and kind of ignored the bacteria, didn't eat them very much. So he called those white blood cells phagocytes. Which means cells that eat. And he said the difference between an animal that was immune and one that wasn't was that the animal that was immune had phagocytes, that they had white blood cells. So it was the cells, not the humors. So was it humoral or was it cellular? Well, it turns out to be a little bit of both. Both are correct, because the cells certainly make lots of soluble stuff, and the soluble stuff has lots of effects on the cells, and it's really one system, as we now know. But the immunity conferred by cells was called cell-mediated immunity, and the immunity conferred by soluble molecules like antibodies is called humoral immunity. Humors, meaning fluids. And to make antibodies in the first place, there has to be an interaction between two specialized kinds of cells called T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes, about which a lot now. Now here's the question. Let me draw you something. Supposing you went into the laboratory and you, some of you taking organic chem? You went to the laboratory and you made like this molecule that nobody's ever made before, as far as you know. Methyl ethyl chicken wire, with an ethyl group here, and, something like that. You made this funny, some funny thing that nobody's, and you have in your tube the world supply of methyl ethyl chicken wire. And then you took a big old foreign protein like bovine serum albumin, which is protein from a cow, and you stick on it some of this methyl ethyl chicken wire. You just attach it, this funny molecule right here. And let's say you take this stuff and you shoot it into Larry Chasen. Well, sounds like a good idea. So Larry Chasen will begin to make antibody to methyl ethyl chicken wire. He'll also make antibody to this part of the molecule. So this is just another epitope now, right? So he'll have some antibody molecules that can recognize this part and some antibody molecules that recognize this thing. But he'll make some antibodies that can recognize methyl ethyl chicken wire, which he didn't have before. So how did Larry know how to do that? Well, how can Larry know how to make antibody against any number of a zillion things, some of which have never existed? Antibody are proteins of about 150 kilodaltons. So that's a lot of DNA. If you code for a zillion molecules, each of which weighs 150 kilodaltons, you don't have enough DNA to do that. So there came to be theories. The first theory was an instructional theory, that in fact, the antigen, this thing, actually instructs you how to make antibody to it. So what happens? Let's say the methyl ethyl chicken wire goes into your body, and you have an antibody molecule that, is just a random protein of some kind, and it kind of wraps itself around this stuff, and then disulfide linkages get put in. It's kind of made as a scaffolding, and it shapes it, and now it's ready to bind another one. Well, that turned out to be bunk, because when we finally got antibody molecules purified, and we could sequence them, we found out that antibody molecules that differ in their specificity of what they recognize differed in an amino acid sequence. That was all there was to it. So how else could you do it? Well, the other idea was clonal selection. Without walking you through all the history of how things were discovered, you should just know that the cells that actually make antibody are called plasma cells. Their precursors are known as B lymphocytes, or B cells. Now, it turns out that Larry had a zillion different B cells. Each of one could make antibody against any one of a zillion things. It also, each mature B lymphocyte had on its surface a sample of the kind of antibody it knew how to make. So, here's a sample on this one. And so each one has a sample. I know how to make this thing. I know how to make this thing. I know how to make this thing. Okay. Well, along comes the antigen, and it binds to this surface antibody molecule known as the B cell receptor. It's just a membrane-bound antibody molecule, and that somehow triggers the proliferation and the differentiation of this particular clone of B cells to make lots more of it, to differentiate into plasma cells, and some of them differentiate into memory cells and just hang around. And they look very much similar, let's say, to the original. So what you're left with at the end is a whole bunch of cells pouring out this antibody, and you also have a bunch of cells, more of these at the end, like instead of one of them, you now have maybe several thousand at the end of all this proliferation. And that turns out to be the case. And it shouldn't have escaped your notice that this process resembles evolution somewhat. Random variation followed by the environment actually selecting what you need. This model explains an awful lot, and we'll get to how it explains memory a little later. But that still leaves us with the problem of how you have enough DNA to do this, to code for zillions of different antibody molecules. One possibility, called the germline theory, is that you simply inherit, somehow, you inherit the DNA from your dad and mom, and it codes for all the antibody molecules you have to make. The other theory is no, you actually inherit very few genes, but they get mutated somehow in your body, and they become different from one another. So all the B cells come out differently. So the idea that all cells have the same DNA ain't so. All these B cells have different DNA that codes for the antibody because it's mutated. It turns out that both ideas are kind of true, and I think that we won't get to it today, so Deborah will finish up for you how your DNA gets scrambled. But basically, you inherit a kit of components, which you shuffle around, and then you mutate. That's the short version. That's the Disney version. Okay, let's look a little bit more closely at what antibody molecules look like. Antibody molecules, mature antibody molecules, consist of four polypeptide chains. Here's the N-terminal end, and this is the C-terminal end. Two identical heavy chains of about 50 kilodaltons each, and two identical light chains of about 25 kilodaltons each. The whole mess is held together by disulfide bridges. They're disulfide bridges between the two heavy chains that hold them together, and there's disulfide bridges that hold the light chain to the heavy chain. And the actual antibody combining site, the one that grabs onto the antigen, is really a combination of what these two chains do together. So that's the end. Each one of these little domains is about 110 amino acids long. So this is what a free antibody molecule looks like. B cells, the precursors to plasma cells, have a kind of antibody molecule with a little bit of a hydrophobic region stuck in at the C-terminus and that float in the membrane and that act as the B-cell receptor. So they make two forms of antibody, the B-cell receptor, which is stuck in the membrane, and a free one, which is the antibody molecule. Now, most of immunology is about another kind of cell known as the T-lymphocyte. And the T-lymphocyte also has a receptor. B and T cells both arise from a common precursor in the bone marrow. B cells complete their maturation in the bone marrow, but T cells have to migrate to an organ called the thymus, which is right above your heart, and they complete their maturation there. So you should know that just like B lymphocytes, T cells have I say T cells and T lymphocytes, I should just say T cells and B cells for short. They have a surface receptor known as the TCR, the T cell receptor. And it looks a little bit like an antibody. There are a couple of differences. So here's a free antibody. The B cell receptor looks like this, but stuck in the membrane. Here's a T cell receptor, which kind of looks like this part of an antibody molecule. See? This beta chain looks kind of like this part of the heavy chain, and this alpha chain looks like this kind of this part of the light chain. And this is capable of binding antigens, but in a funny way. So unlike the B cell receptor, it doesn't come in two forms, a soluble form known as antibodies and a membrane-bound form known as the B cell receptor. There is no soluble form of the T cell receptor. It stays stuck in the membrane. So it's always the TCR, T cell receptor, and the BCR, the B cell receptor. And there's yet another wrinkle still. Everybody with me so far? Are I getting the deer in the headlights look from people? So far, so good? Okay. Now, B cells, I misspoke. Antibody molecules bind antigens directly. So here is an antibody molecule, and it's bound to this epitope, this part of this protein, apparently. It could be bound to this part or that part, depending on what its specificity is. Now, since it binds directly to antigens, it tends to bind to the outside of this ball of fuzz, or this string ball, because that's what's hydrophilic, and it's on the outside. That's what it binds to. But T cells like greasy peptides. They like more hydrophobic peptides, and they won't bind them directly. They'll only bind peptides when they are presented to them on the surface of another cell, complexed with a molecule known as the MHC molecule. So here's another cell. Here's an MHC molecule on the surface of that cell, and here's a peptide, around 15 long, bound in this groove on the MHC molecule, like a hot dog in a bun. And the T cell receptor recognizes this complex of peptide and MHC molecule. So it doesn't bind antigens directly, it binds them indirectly. And of course, since it likes greasy, since MHC molecules bind only these hydrophobic kinds of peptides, it's probably coming from the inside of the molecule. See? So what you have to do to present a peptide to a T cell receptor is you have to chop up this cell right here that's presenting it. First had to take this protein, chop it up into pieces, and take this piece and load it onto MHC and present it, and then the T cell comes along and a T cell receptor recognizes this. So what TCRs see are mostly antigenic peptides. Now, MHC molecules, there are lots of different alleles of MHC molecules, as we'll learn later. There's so many that they're used in forensics. People differ a lot in their MHC molecules. And they're the molecules that determine whether you can transplant bone marrow, skin, or anything from one person to another. If they have the same MHC molecules, you can. If they don't, you can't. And in fact, the long name is major histocompatibility complex molecules. So these are the molecules that determine whether you can transplant stuff. Anyway, the MHC specificity for binding molecules and presenting them is not that tight. I mean, each MHC molecule allele has a preference for a certain kind of peptide, but it's not an absolutely tight preference. So it binds peptides, this peptide and peptides like it. Okay. Now things get complicated, so we have to make sure that everybody's with this. Yes. Where is it bound?
Where is it bound in the cell?
Where is it? It's on the surface of the cell, so that a T cell can come along and recognize it. It's being presented on the surface of the cell, and we'll find out in a little while how it got there. We'll talk about how the peptide gets to the MHC. It turns out that T lymphocytes are further divided into two kinds of T lymphocytes. Let's see where this is important enough to put sort of central. Let's erase this thing. Yeah. Okay, naive T lymphocytes, and those aren't, as I said this morning, they're not T lymphocytes that vote Republican. Naive T lymphocytes are T lymphocytes that have not yet seen their antigen. They're naive. They're divided into two kinds, TH and TCs. These are sometimes called helpers, and these are sometimes called killers. They're characterized by surface proteins that are peculiar to each. TH cells have on their surface a molecule called CD8, and CD4. And TC molecules have on their surface a molecule called CD8. So that's characterized by that. And it turns out that this turns out to be important. Well, so there are two flavors of naive T cells, TCs and THs. Now, when they become effectors, that means when these naive cells get activated to do something, they do various things. TCs can only do one thing in life, and they become CTLs when they grow up. When they become effectors, they become cytotoxic T lymphocytes. And cytotoxic T lymphocytes have only one job to do, and that job is to kill your own cells when they go funny. By going funny, I mean they're infected with a virus, they're cancerous, they're infected with a bacterium, something strange about them. Cytotoxic T lymphocytes will take those of your own cells and kill them. They don't kill bacteria or viruses, they just kill your own cells. That's their job. And their precursors are CD8 positive TC cells. Now THs, when they get activated, it can do a whole bunch of stuff, and it's just not within the scope of this lecture to tell you about all the things that they can do. We'll talk about some of the things that they can do when they become activated. Well, conveniently, or inconveniently, and to give you a big headache, but I'll give you a mnemonic for handling it, MHC molecules also come in two flavors. So T cells come in two flavors, and MHC molecules come in two flavors. There's MHC class 1 molecules and MHC class 2 molecules, okay? MHC class 2 molecules have two polypeptide chains, and MHC class 1 only has one, although it's complex with something else. But basically, in overall 3D structure, they're very similar. This is like the hot dog and the bun. You're looking at the hot dog end on, okay? So they're different, MHC class 1 and MHC class 2, in several ways. The way the peptides get there is different. The cells that present each kind are different. And the kind of T cell that likes them are different. TH cells, like MHC class 1, class 2, sorry, see? I can't multiply. And CD8 cells, like MHC class 1. Now, how are you going to remember this? Well, the product is always 8. 4 times 2, 8. 8 times 1. That's just a mnemonic for you. Now, I said that the cells that have them are different. All your nucleated cells in your body, just about all of them, have MHC class 1 molecules. So all your cells are presenting peptides on class 1 MHC all the time. But some special cells also present antigens on the surface of MHC class 2. And not strangely, those cells are called antigen-presenting cells. And here are the three main ones. First of all, there are dendritic cells. These dendritic cells have nothing to do with nerve cells. It just has to do with the fact that dendritic cells, if you look carefully, have these long processes that come out of them. But dendritic cells are the only cells that can actually present antigens to naive T cells. No other antigen-presenting cell can do this effectively. It's a phagocytic cell, it eats lots of stuff, and it also drinks, it's pinocytotic, and it takes samples of what it ate and drank and presents it on its surface in complex with MHC2. But it also has MHC1. All cells have MHC1. These, in addition to it, have MHC2 as well. So these are the three antigen-presenting cells. Macrophages, big eaters. They're sentinels. They sit in your tissues and they wait to pounce on bacteria that happen to get there. They'll yum them up. And they're macrophages in virtually all your tissues. And they're sentinels. They hang around and will jump on invaders. But they can also present antigens on MHC2. And finally, there's our old friend, the B lymphocyte. The B lymphocyte can also present antigens on MHC2. All these cells have, they're a diverse group, but they have some common features. They take in antigen, protein antigen from the outside, they break it down into peptides, they load it onto MHC2, and they put it on their surface for T cells to come look at. So how do antigens get onto the MHC molecule in the first place? Well, and which antigens end up on MHC1 and which end up on MHC2? Well, here's a virus-infected cell. It's making its proteins on your ribosomes. And these proteins that are made in your cytosol are going to get chopped up, transported. I can't talk about the machinery in this class. It's just too detailed. But it gets transported into the endoplasmic reticulum, where it gets loaded onto MHC1 molecules and transported in vesicles to the surface. Well, it's not only viral proteins that get that have this treatment, but all the proteins in your cytosol, all your own proteins in the cytosol get degraded, they get turned over, and they get transported and displayed on the surface of your cell, complexed with MHC1 molecules, peptides from those proteins. So your cells are constantly displaying on their surface a sample of the proteins that are present in their cytosol. They're saying, here's what's inside me, take a look. And T cells can scavenge, can look at them and see if there's something funny there. And if there is, the cytotoxic T lymphocytes will kill them. So you're constantly displaying on the surface of your cells stuff that you made in your cytosol. What about MHC2? MHC2 is not stuff that you made, but stuff that you ate, that you took in from the outside. So, here's a macrophage. It's eating a bacterium. The bacterium is in this endocytic vesicle. It gets broken down to peptides. It gets loaded on MHC2. It gets transported to the surface. The same thing happens in dendritic cells, another phagocytic cell. So, these two phagocytic cells, dendritic cells and macrophages, do this. They take in antigen from the outside, they chop it up, they put it in MHC2. Now, B cells do it a little differently. They're not phagocytic cells. They don't eat stuff randomly. But anything that their surface antibody, it says antibody should really say B cell receptor, anything that their B cell receptor sees leads to a receptor-mediated endocytosis. This antigen gets chopped up into peptides. The peptides get loaded on MHC2 and go to the surface of the cell. And we'll see what that does. Okay, deep breath. People are demyelinating from this, or you're okay? Okay, what questions do you have? One. The only cells that can effectively display antigens to naive T cells are dendritic cells. We have to have a very brief digression. Oh, we have about half an hour? No, a little bit more than that. Okay, so fasten seatbelts a little. No, let me explain. There's another whole immune system. The immune system we've been talking about now is called the adaptive immune system. Adaptive. It means that it's in response to something. So the adaptive immune system. This is the business with T cells and B cells and antibody molecules and cytotoxic T lymphocytes. These are the things you make in response to a particular invader, specifically aimed at eliminating that. But you have a more general system called the innate system, which is always there. Like having skin. Skin keeps you from getting invaded, and it's always there. It's part of your innate system. Most of the invaders, most of the stuff that comes to you is eliminated by the innate system before it ever gets to the adaptive system. If it breaks through the innate system will alert the adaptive system and get it rolling. And we'll talk about how that happens. The innate system also has receptors of a different kind, which we can't talk about, but they know. They have detectors that will tell you if something is worth responding to. These detectors will say there's something weird in the neighborhood, and it don't look good. So what they'll do is they'll start kicking in the adaptive system if they can't control it by themselves. And two major participants in this are our friends, the dendritic cells and the macrophages. I can't tell you how they know because that's the subject of the whole course. And there's one offered in the fall. Anyway, let's take a look. Now we can understand a little bit more about these two interactions. Okay. Here is a dendritic cell presenting a peptide to a naive T lymphocyte. Okay? Now, this peptide is complex with MHC2, but you can't see it. It's just not shown in the picture. But it's complex to MHC2. It doesn't just put naked peptides to display. So the dendritic cell ate something, like ate a bacterium or something. It chopped it up into pieces, presented a peptide from it. This T cell happens to have a TCR that recognizes it, and that gives a kick to this T cell called signal 1. But that doesn't activate the lymphocyte. In fact, that will shut down the lymphocyte unless it gets a second signal from the dendritic cell called signal 2. I can't discuss today what that signal 2 is, but it's some molecular interaction. And the dendritic cell won't do this unless its innate receptors have been tripped, unless it knows that there's something that's worth responding to. So this dendritic cell can either shut down this lymphocyte, for example, if it's presenting some self-peptide here. There's nothing dangerous around, so it'll shut this thing down rather than activating it. But if its innate receptors have been tripped, it sends signal 2 as well. Now this activated T lymphocyte can go and become a helper to a B cell. Well, here's a B lymphocyte, here's a B cell, and it sees its antigen and it takes it in. That's signal 1. So it gives it a little kick. Now it takes that antigen and it chops it up into little pieces and it presents it on MHC2, and this T lymphocyte happens to recognize one of the peptides. And that delivers, and that recognition is signal 2 for the B cell. So both T cells and B cells need two signals to get rolling. Now the epitope that this B cell receptor and this T cell receptor sees are different epitopes. Remember that the B cell receptor likes outside stuff, soluble stuff, and this T cell receptor likes greasy stuff. So they're probably looking at different pieces of this molecule. It grabbed onto the outside and internalized it and chopped it up, and one of the internal peptides is recognized by this thing. So usually antigens need to be of a certain size before they get to be effective immunogens that they can immunize you. It has to have two funny things about it before it begins to trigger an immune response. But anyway, here's a table I hope will not make it too confusing. A B cell, we'll start at the bottom, gets its first signal from the antigen when its B cell receptor sees it, and it gets help from a T cell when the T cell recognizes the peptide that it's presenting. A T helper cell, the TH cell, gets its first signal from an MHC2 peptide on the surface of a dendritic cell from an antigen-presenting cell, and it gets its second signal from there. TCs get a second signal. They get the first signal from MHC1 peptide, but the second signal from a TH, but in a funny way that we can't talk about here. It's beyond the scope of this lecture. So putting them all together, whenever they get their two signals, they become effector cells. Well, here's a sort of put it all together diagram. Okay, here's an antigen presenting cell. Let's say this is a dendritic cell up here. It's presenting peptides on class 2 and peptides on class 1. Now, this naive TH cell recognizes its peptide presented to it on a class 2 MHC molecule, and the antigen-presenting cell also gives it signal 2. Now it's becoming an activated TH cell. It's now active. Now that it's activated, it can now help B cells become activated. The B cell needs antigen and some help from the TH cell, right? And it becomes an antibody-producing cell. Now, the same thing happens to a TC cell. It gets activated by two signals. One from a class 1 molecule complex with an MHC. A peptide complex with an MHC class 1 molecule. And then it gets help from T cells, from T helper cells in an indirect way. So these CD8 cells are helped by these CD4 cells. Remember, THs are CD4, TCs are CD8. So this TH cell, this activated TH cell, is necessary to activate B cells, and it is also necessary to get cytotoxic T lymphocytes. Well, the CD4 cells are the ones that HIV, that AIDS virus, kills. So if you knock this out, what happens? You can't make antibodies, and you can't make cytotoxic T lymphocytes either. You just lose everything. That's why it's so devastating. I know it's hard to keep all these things straight in your head. You know, which is MHC1, which is MHC2, which is CD8, and CD4, and TCs, and THs. It's a lot of terminology. Anyway, what good does antibody do you? You should make a little chart. You should just say TC, CD8, TH, CD4. You know, that sort of thing. Okay. So what good do antibody molecules do to you? You know something about antibody molecules. You know that they have two grabbers, so that if you have a bunch of bacteria and a bunch of antibody to the bacteria, it can cause them to clump, right? You already had this in some context. That obviously if you have little antibody molecules grabbing two bacteria, clumping them together, and other antibody molecules clumping other bacteria, you get a big clump of bacteria and antibody molecules. Now, if you were a macrophage running around trying to chase down bacteria, would you rather eat, you know, chase down one bacterium, chase down another one and another one, or eat a nice big juicy clump of bacteria? It's easier. So they agglutinate. That's one thing that antibody molecules do. They agglutinate bacteria. In other words, they clump them. It's a fancy word for clumping. But there's other stuff they do too. They opsonize bacteria. Opsonize is a fancy word for to make yummy. Here is a macrophage, and it's not eating these bacteria at all. It doesn't like them. But if antibody comes in, it coats these bacteria with antibody molecules, and anything coated with an antibody molecule is very yummy for phagocytic cells. Because phagocytic cells have receptors, which are, you can barely see here, which like this constant part of antibody molecule. So it grabs onto this part, and in it goes, yum, yum, yum. And it chews it up, and that's the end of it. So it will opsonize, so they say, yeah, it opsonizes, in other words, makes them yummy. Same thing happens. Let's suppose you have a bacterial toxin. In order to kill your cells, it has to complex with some sort of surface on a receptor on that cell so it can get into the cell and kill it. Well, if your antibody gets to it first, it gums up, it complexes with this toxin, and guess what happens? It'll get yummed up by a macrophage or some other phagocytic cell because it has these nice juicy constant parts of the antibody hanging there, and they like to grab onto those. So they'll grab onto those, particularly when they're clustered in groups, and in it goes and chews it up. Now, in your serum, you have a bunch of proteins called, collectively, complement. Complement isn't a thing. It's a bunch of proteins that have enzymatic activity that act on each other in a cascade, sort of like blood clotting. Have you had blood clotting? No. Well, there's a cascade of proteins that act on each other. And it's a very, very complex mechanism. We won't go through it thank goodness, tonight. But if you have bacteria in your plasma and antibody complexes with it, that activates complement. That gets the complement cascade rolling. And the complement cascade does two things. It further opsonizes these bacteria, because the complement itself starts to coat the bacteria with something called C3b. You don't have to know this, but some of the complement stuff further yummifies it, sugar coats this thing so that phagocytes really love it. And it also activates a bunch of enzymes that can actually blast a hole in the cell membrane. So antibody molecules complex with something are able to activate complement and opsonize and poke holes in it. So that's some of the things that antibody does for you. What about your cellular immunity, your cytotoxic T lymphocytes? Well, we mentioned this already, and we have a better picture of it than this, that if you have an infected cell, it will display funny peptides on its surface, complex with MHC1, and cytotoxic T lymphocytes will come and kill them. This shouldn't say TC. That's not the effector cell. It should say cytotoxic T lymphocyte, which it does down here, but not there. It should say CTL. And we won't deal with this because we are running out of time. Maybe if we have time, we'll go back to it. Here's a better picture. And it makes several points, too. So let's take a look at it a little bit more closely. Okay, here's an infected cell. But it's infected with a virus. It's got some of the viral peptides being presented on MHC class 1 molecules. Here's a cytotoxic T lymphocyte, not a TC. Cytotoxic T lymphocyte. It's recognizing its peptide MHC complex. So it recognizes this combination of the two. And it also, this whole relationship is stabilized by its CD8. CD8 likes to grab onto this constant part of MHC class 1 molecules, the same way that CD4 likes to grab onto MHC class 2 molecules. So this whole thing is held together by two things, by the CD8 holding onto the MHC and the TCR, the T cell receptor, holding onto the MHC peptide complex. And when it sees this, it kills that cell. How does it kill it? Well, we can't talk about it in detail, but more or less it convinces it to commit suicide. Now, T cells, just like B cells, when they see their antigen, they get activated, they also undergo clonal expansion, and they become effector cells and memory cells, and these other cells that sort of look like the first cell that started out. They both go through that same thing. And they also have, just like B cells, they have very different receptors from one another, and they do this by scrambling their DNA. It's very much the same way. And I think Dr. Deborah will tell you about what's called VDJ recombination, which is how they scramble their DNA to make all these different receptors. So, what good is memory anyway? Oh, let's ignore this. Okay, you remember what this does. Okay, this particular B cell encounters its antigen with a little help from a T helper cell, from a CD4 positive T cell. It will begin to get activated, differentiate into plasma cells, which pour out antibody, and also some memory cells, they're called, which just hang around and don't do anything much, except make more of what this originally was. So what are the results of this? First of all, effector cells like plasma cells don't live long. You don't want the immune system, once it gets going, to keep rolling. You want it to die out. If the immune system has breaks built in all over the place. So you begin to get plasma cells, for a time, put out antibody, and then they croak. These cells, however, hang on for a long time. So let's see, what are the results of that? What does that produce? It produces something very important called primary and secondary responses. Let's take a bunny and let's inject him with an antigen. Let's say bovine serum albumin, some foreign protein. And let's measure the antibody at different days in his serum. Let's just take serum samples and measure the antibody. First thing we see is that nothing much happens. there's not much rise in the amount of antibody in his serum. And then, after a lag, we begin to see a slow, pokey rise in antibody concentration, and it kind of plateaus, and it kind of poops out like that. So that's a primary response to an antigen. Now, let's suppose we wait, and that's about 20 days it begins to poop out. Then, let's say we wait until 2 months, and then we give it a boost. We give it another shot of antigen A. What happens is that there's no lag. There's an immediate rise in the antibody in its serum, and it's a bigger rise. So there's no lag, and it also goes a lot higher. How much higher? Well, this is a log scale, so this is like 1,000 times that. Right? See, 10 to the 0, this is like 10 to the 3, 4, right? And it stays up for quite a while. So, what does that do to? It's due to the fact that by the time you've given it second dose of antigen, it's got all these memory cells hanging around. So instead of having one lonely clone thing to begin clonal expansion, it's got 1,000 of them. So it's a much stronger response. Also, the kind of, we can't talk about it here, the kind of antibody is kind of different. This is kind of a crappy antibody. This is a much better, more effective, more avid antibody. And how that happens is an advanced course. Anyhow, so you say, well, Dr. MXY, this is just a jazzed up bunny, that's all. Any old antigen, if you shot it into here, it just saw a foreign antigen, it got over this thing. So non-specifically, if you put in, let's say, a weird keyhole limpet hemocyanin and some protein here, it would respond like that to it too. Well, if you give it a different antigen, it gives the same old pokey primary response. So it's specific for the antigen which was here. So the secondary response is due to these memory cells that are left over from the primary response. And that's why the second time you get exposed to an illness after you've recovered from it, you pounce on it. It's that simple. I see a question. There was a question. Yes. Antigen A and antigen A have to be the same. Yes, if you boost it with a different antigen, you'll get another primary response and not this big secondary response. It has to be the same antigen because it doesn't have memory cells hanging around to antigen B, to the second shot of antigen B. It only has memory cells to antigen A because it's seen that one before. Everybody sort of get it? Okay? Now, we've talked about lots and lots of different cells, maybe too many. We talked about B and T lymphocytes and macrophages and dendritic cells, all these different kinds of cells. How do these cells find each other? Do they just sort of bang around in your body and hope to find each other? Well, it turns out you have lymphoid tissue. You have lymphoid tissue, and what are examples of it? Lymph nodes, Peyer's patches, tonsils, there's all kinds of lymphoid tissue associated with your mucosa. You have these specific organs and your spleen. They have specific structures where these cells can get together and meet and greet. They're kind of the water coolers of your immune system where all these cells get together and they say, hey, I've got this antigen. Do you have a TCR specific for it? Say, yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. So they get together there. So they're concentrated in those areas. They're specifically attracted to each other and to them. And these interactions are very, they're fun, but they're beyond the scope of this introductory lecture. Okay. I would be remiss if I didn't give the famous characteristics of the adaptive immune system. So all of this B cell and T cell stuff is all the adaptive immune system. They exhibit, and you have to put this on the board, it's de rigueur, although they're English words. First of all, the adaptive immune system has specificity. That means an antibody molecule will recognize an antigen and won't recognize a closely related antigen, even if it differs in one amino acid sometimes. It will not cross-react. So it can be very specific. Diversity. Diversity just means you can make antibody against any one of a million different things. Memory. We talked about that. The innate system doesn't show any memory. Your innate system reacts the second time, the third time, the fourth time the same way, but your adaptive system remembers what you've seen. And tolerance means you can distinguish self from non-self. It means that you tolerate your own antigens. You don't make antibodies or cytotoxic T lymphocytes to your own antigens. How does that happen? Well, that's also beyond the scope, but I can tell you that during development of B cells and of T cells, if they encounter a self-antigen, that makes them croak. So you get rid of them. There are other mechanisms as well, but there are many, many other mechanisms. That, of course, breaks down sometimes, and you get an autoimmune disease. Okay. We have enough time. What do you know? Okay. So we have a cast of characters. We have B cells that are precursors to the cells that make antibody. We have CD8 T cells, the killers that kill your own funny looking cells. We have CD4 T cells, or the helpers that activate B cells and activate CD8 T cells. We have dendritic cells that detect invaders and present antigen to naive T cells. We have macrophages, which are sentinels in the tissue which eat invaders and present antigen to non-naive T cells. For example, macrophages can activate memory cells. Memory cells are much more easily activated than naive T cells. But here's one more cell that I want to tell you about called the neutrophil. We have enough time to talk about them. Neutrophils, sometimes called polymorphonuclear leukocytes because they have funny looking nuclei. But neutrophils is the more scientific name for them. And they're phagocytic cells. They eat things. Only they don't have receptors, either innate or adaptive receptors on their surface. So to detect foreign invaders and to know what to eat. So how do they know what to eat? Do they just eat, you know, whatever? No. They have to be told by other cells what to eat. To show you that these guys are really the workhorses and the red shirts of your immune army, here's what, please don't memorize this, but this is just to give you some sort of physical idea of what's hanging around in your serum. Here are the leukocytes, which means the white blood cells. You have about 1,000 red cells for every white blood cell you have, you know, roughly. Maybe a little less than 1,000 to 1, but okay, but you know, 800 and something relative to 1. So these leukocytes are mostly neutrophils. Over half of them are neutrophils. About a third of them are the lymphocytes, the B and T lymphocytes, also another lymphocyte, which is my favorite, called the natural killer. And a smattering of other types. And we can't talk about those. But the only point that I'm making on this slide is that neutrophils really are most of your white blood cells. Or should be. If they're not, then there's something wrong. Well, let's talk about inflammation. Inflammation was described by Galen a long time ago. And it has several... And he described it in Latin as rubor, which means it's red. If you have a local inflammation, it's red. Calor means it's hot. Dolor means that it hurts. Tumor means it's swollen. And loss of function, there's only one more, even though it says two more, loss of function. How does that happen? Well, here's how it happens. Inflammation is something that happens to your blood vessels, primarily. And we'll explain what I mean by that. Here's a blood vessel going through your tissues. And here's all kinds of cells inside your blood vessel. Red cells and, you know, white cells of different kinds. Here is in your tissues, here is a macrophage. And the macrophage has just detected a bacterium. It's eaten it. Its innate receptors have gone off. And it starts putting out cytokines and chemokines. They both are chemical signals that act on other cells. Chemokines are usually chemical attractants. And some cells who have receptors for the cytokines, the chemokines and chemical attractants, and some cells who have receptors for them will crawl up the gradient to wherever it is. Well, the cytokines act on these endothelial cells which line the blood vessel and create vasodilation. It expands and also becomes leaky. Well, because of the vasodilation, you get your rubor and your calor, because there's more blood going to the area. It gets hot and it gets red. And it becomes leaky, so fluids pour in and it swells and it hurts. That's inflammation. And you lose your function, which is a good idea, because if you have an infection, you don't want to move it around a lot. You want to keep it still so the infection doesn't spread. So the loss of function is actually very good for you in most cases. So here, neutrophils, it does another thing. It not only makes the endothelial cells leaky and create vasodilation, but it also makes them sticky for our friends, the neutrophils. They stick to it and squeeze through and climb up this gradient of chemokines and eat the bacteria. Now let's talk about one fun thing we can actually talk about. Oh, do not memorize this. This is only for your reference in case you wanted to know. All the zoo of different cells that we presented today are all related to each other. They all arise from a common precursor called the pluripotent hematopoietic stem cell in your bone marrow. And here's how they differentiate from one another. And the particular ways that they're driven to differentiate in these ways, that's obviously beyond the scope of today's talk. Okay, let's take another look at our friends, the MHC molecules. Don't panic. The only point I want to make on this slide is that MHC is polygenic. That means you have more than one gene that codes for MHC molecules. Let's forget about MHC2, which have two polypeptide chains. It's very complicated. HLA is just the medical name for human MHC, from human leukocyte antigen. Don't worry about it. These are MHC molecules. Let's look at the class 1 MHC molecules. It turns out that you have three different genes. You have HLA A, B, and C. They're different. Now, you have two copies of HLA A gene, one from your dad and one from your mom. So you have two HLA A molecules. And you have two HLA B molecules. And you have two HLA C genes. Okay? They're all codominant. They're all expressed. None of these are dominant. You're making HLA A, and you're making HLA B, and you're making HLA C. These are different kinds, different genes coding for MHC class 1 molecules. So they're polygenic, but they're also polymorphic. There are lots of alleles of HLA-A, and lots of alleles of HLA-B, lots of alleles of HLA-C. So how many different MHC1 molecules are on the surface of any one of your cells? Well, you have two different ones. You have an allele from your dad and an allele from your mom of A. You have an allele from your dad and an allele from your mom of B. And you have one from your dad and one from your mom of C. So you're expressing six different HLA or six different MHC class 1 molecules on the surface of every cell. My other point is that it's not only polygenic, it's also polymorphic. Let's forget the rest, let's just look at MHC class 1. MHC class 1 molecules, let's just look at HLA-A. You have 414 different alleles of this banging around in the population. Now, they're not all equally frequent, but if they were, the chances that the one you got from your dad, the one you got from your mom, were the same would be 1 in 1,600, more or less. And the chances that you got this... Okay, so if you look at any two individuals, in order to get a transplant, a bone marrow or something, other kind of transplant from somebody else, you have to match all your MHC molecules, right? So what are the chances that you'd have the same two Bs and the same two Cs and the same two As as some random schmo in the population? Very tiny. Very tiny. That's why it's hard to find a bone marrow donor. And it's even harder for MHC class 2, but you have to match all of them in order to accept a transplant. I want to talk about another concept briefly called haplotype. Do you guys know what a haplotype is? No. A haplotype. When you have a bunch of genes that are very closely linked on the DNA, they're all located together. The chances that there's a recombinational event inside there is very rare. It happens maybe in less than 1% of the cases. So usually, if you inherit any one of these, you inherit the whole bunch. And that group, that whole bunch of genes is called a haplotype. It's inherited like a gene, but it's really a bunch of different genes. So the MHC class, the MHC region is pretty small overall, and it's inherited usually you'd inherit the whole thing. It's very rare to have a recombinational event inside here. So let's take a look at the haplotypes of a dad and a mom. Dad is a red-blue, and mom is a green-yellow, and their kids are, you know, one from dad, one from mom, so they get a green from mom and a blue from dad, and yada, yada, yada. Okay, so in order to get a transplant from somebody, you have to have the same haplotype as the donor. So, can the dad donate skin or bone marrow or anything to one of these kids? No, the dad cannot donate. Can any one of the kids donate to the dad? Anybody? No, they can't. So they're all different. So you can't donate between parents and kids and between kids and parents. However, one in four of your siblings is going to have the same as you. So if you're in trouble and you need a bone marrow transplant, look at a sibling. There's a 1 in 4 chance that the sibling is going to have the same haplotype as you do, and you'll be able to get a bone marrow transplant or whatever you need. And as I mentioned this morning, what inspired me to just put this up is that I saw a House episode where it said, well, he can get a bone marrow transplant from dad. The answer is no, he can't unless dad married his own sister. Now, here's something fun and cool, I think. They have funny names. MHC alleles have funny names. They usually, these are called like A1, A2, A3, A4, A5 through A414, and B through, et cetera. The MHC class 2s are called DP, DQ, and DR, and that's all you have to know. That's just handles. That's what they're called. And let's take a look at people who have different MHC class genes. It turns out that having all this tremendous... Why on earth are we selected to reject transplants? Why would we know how to reject a transplant? What use is it to reject a transplant? That's not what's useful. What's useful is to have such a variety of MHC genes in the population and MHC alleles that we're presenting, everybody presents very different peptides on the surfaces of their cells for T cells to respond to, so that if there's an epidemic of a brand new virus, somebody in the population is likely to mount an effective response to that virus. So you get hybrid, that's why it's dangerous to have only one kind of corn, for example, because, you know, rust can come and wipe it all out. The same thing with people. It's a good thing that we vary so much in our... However, the fact that it protects the population as a whole to have such a variety, some combinations of MHC genes are not good for you. So, for example, anybody here sensitive to gluten? It's very common. You probably have DR3, a particular MHC2 gene. If you have that, you are 12 times more likely than a random person to be allergic to gluten. Some of them are much more serious, like ankylosing spondylitis is a very serious disease, and if you have this MHC1 gene, B27, you're 90 times more likely to get this disease as a random person. How about diabetes? If you have a combination, if you have both DR, if you have 4 and 3 alleles of MHC2 DR, you're 90 times more likely. And here's muscular sclerosis. Some of these are autoimmune diseases. Some of them are really, really mysterious. So, for example, narcolepsy, like in this class. if you have this particular MHC2 gene, DR2, if you have that allele, you're 130 times more likely than a random schmo to be narcoleptic. Now, how does that work? Well, maybe one of you guys is going to figure it out. Thanks.
Psychologist?
A mouse oncologist. Oh. And I was a cancer researcher. I call myself a mouse oncologist.
Okay, cool.
Oh, I better turn this thing off. Everybody has to listen to this. All right, how do you turn this thing off? Like that.